How do you define America's objectives in a post 9/11 world in terms of how it relates not only to fighting Al Qaeda and other terrorist organizations, but a sense of what America wants to be and do?
Yes. I would define it in the following way, and let me say that 9/11 was an earthquake in much the way Pearl Harbor was an earthquake. So, of course, it altered our strategic perspective. It altered the lives of everyday Americans. It altered our strategic perspective. But there are some elements that are very common to what the president talked about. He said he was going to get the big ones right. He was going to have good relations with Russia and good relations with China and good relations with India. And he's achieved that. When we were just in Asia, Charlie, it was amazing to realize that what the United States has achieved is to have good relations with China, Japan, South Korea, Russia. It was often said in international relations, you know, that you couldn't have good relations with all of them simultaneously. Well, we do.
Because they all had different interests.
Well, in fact, we forged a set of common interests. And it's working, for instance, to help with something like the North Korea problem.
Okay, where tell me where that is,
Your very important point about how America sees its role in the world. America is unique in terms of its influence, in terms of its capabilities, and in terms of its power at this particular point in history. And this president believes that that has to be used for big goals, not small ones. He believes that you can't sweep problems under the rug. He believes that you have to confront problems. And so whether on the security side you have the need to on the proliferation side, tell people that no, it wasn't working with North Korea. No, it wasn't working with Iran. No, having Iraq for 12 years defy the United Nations on 17 different resolutions, it wasn't working. And we had to confront that. And we did Iraq in a particular way, but with North Korea and Iran, we've been able to build multilateral coalitions to deal with those problems. This president has said, we cannot negotiate with terrorists. I don't care where they are. I don't care if the terrorists are in Kashmir, or if they are in the Palestinian territories, or if they're in New York City. You have to have a concerted effort against terrorists, recognizing who they are, and you have to have a systematic way of dealing with them, with their financing, with everything about them. And then, interestingly, though, that same approach that you have to confront security issues, America, that's America's role, it's also America's role to confront disease and poverty, so that this is the president who, on AIDS...
Shut the hell up, Condoleezza Rice. This nonsense about we did Iraq in a particular way, as opposed to Korea and other nations. Yeah, you did do Iraq in a particular way. Carpet bomb, shock and awe, genocidal way that knocked off 15,000 right from the bat of your recent bombings. And of course it's different from the way you're trying to do Korea, because them Buddhists don't play that stuff. Just ask Little Kim. And then you have the nerve to babble out how America's unique. Unique to what? Christian slavery? Christian genocide? As opposed to Islamic slavery and Islamic genocide? I mean, in the world of imperialism and domination of other world cultures and stuff, how unique is America? Except for the fact that going to be black folks in America who are going to be in the forefront of taking Sam's ass down. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check this out. Listening to 104.1, 96.3 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois. LUVER.com. The World Slave Revolt Time. Tonight we're going to have Gerald shooting off and then you making a plain news update. And so deal with some issues in the Berkeley Daily Planet. Then we're going to explore what the hell is going on in the politics of sports as we deal with the Rush Limbaugh McNabb statement, as we deal with issues of Warren Sapp saying that football players are slaves. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt Radio.
Of the daughters, the wounds of the sons, the wounds of the children of my people wound me too. The wounds of the daughters, the wounds of the sons, the wounds of the children of my people wound me too. Who will turn my head? Who will turn my head into a fountain and my eyes into a stream so that I might cry,
my eyes into a stream,
so that I might cry all day, all night for all of the wounds of the daughters, the wounds of the sons, the wounds of the children. Of
all
my people,
night, the wounds of the daughters, of the sons, of my people, of our children, our children, our children, our children, our children.
And those who are wounded will be rising up. Listen to the wounded.
On the backs of their plantation, new plantation industry dreams, we
the wounded will be rising
our
up.
Brothers,
none of us
we
are free.
Say, free, Mumia, free,
none
Mumia,
of us are free,
Leonard Peltier,
none of us are free,
Geronimo DiGiaga Pratt,
free,
Mumia, Abu Jamal, free, Mumia, Abu Jamal, free, Mumia, Abu Jamal,
free,
parking,
free,
checking, free,
free,
coupons, free,
free,
freedom is a road seldom traveled by the politicians, free,
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 mine, so your ass will follow, free, mine, so your ass might follow, free, mine, so your ass has an opportunity to follow,
free,
children,
free, free to marry whom we love, free to marry whom we love, free to marry whom we love, none of us are free until all of us are free,
free
to walk and talk and live and breathe,
free to
$223 a month,
free
is not
to raise
free.
Our children whole, and the right to control our bodies,
free
the
to
right
raise
for our sisters,
voices.
Free.
Free to raise our voices, none of us are free.
Freedom
until
is a road.
All of us are free.
Seldom traveled by Mr. Clinton. I'm not talking about George. Yeah. Freedom is a road seldom traveled by those of us who live close to the white ivory towered lie, suit and tie hypnotize niggas in suits and ties. But what about those of us on the pavement, close to the earth, living? How can $223 a month feed anyone, let alone a baby, a mother? Free.
Free. None of us are free.
Who is free?
Until all of us are free.
Friends, and I see some enemies. fact, I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we had an audience this large and didn't realize that there were some enemies present.
Yes, good evening, brothers and sisters. I'm Gerald Smith, and this is your Making It Plain News Service.
Well, Berkeley Bowl workers took it in the shorts, folks. Or was it a cell phone? The Berkeley Daily Planet framed it this way. Berkeley Bowl workers reject unionization bid. Maybe there's a little bit more to the story, but for sure, they lost the vote. The people that were for the union lost the vote after more than 4 months of intensive organizing efforts and the firing of two Berkeley Bowl workers that were pro-union. Berkeley Bowl workers rejected unionization effort in a National Labor Relations Board supervised election Thursday. The final tally,
119 against the union, 70 for the union.
Many of the union advocates who weren't working when the results were announced left the store in shock, gathering outside as the news sunk in. Quote, "I'm not beat down over this," said Kevin Meyer, one of the most involved pro-union employees. "We've done good work." Leah Hite, Berkeley Bowl's human resource business partner, said she thought the vote was an accurate appraisal of the sentiment among employees.
Well, what the hell you think she's going to say?
Now, there is an important lesson here, because the Berkeley Bowl struggle did attract some attention. A lot of people came out to support them. What did they do? They filed with the National Labor Relations Board. That meant that in a specified amount of time, there was going to be an election as to whether or not there's a union. But what also happens in that specified amount of time? Well, I'll tell you what happens. It gives the company time to wage an anti-union campaign, which they did. And apparently, the people that were, you know, really the core of the pro-union elements thought they had it made. They thought everybody was going to vote for the union. Because, in fact, the union had signed up 70% of the workforce with them cards. They signed the cards. How in the hell, then, if they signed the cards, could they lose the election? It doesn't add up. Or does it? Let's go back to that NLRB election business. They give, there's a certain amount of months, it might be 3 months or 2 months, from when you file, then you have an election. That gives the company time to go into overdrive. They hired a special so-called human. When they say human resources these days, you better beware. Put your hand over your pocket. They hired a special human resource person, you understand, to help the company combat the union. This is psychological warfare, see? When you go to build a union, it's class war. That's what it is. And they went and got a consultant to help them, that is Berkeley Bowl management, went and hired a consultant to help them wage class war against the people, the workers, you know, that work there. Now look, this is America. This is not, you know, Colombia. This is not, you know, someplace in Africa where we used to come out for a union and people start getting murdered. We're not at that state of a class struggle here in America. But what they can do is mess with that mind. They start telling people stuff like this. Well, if y'all win the election, we're going to have to close down and go back to a smaller location because we can't handle it. We can't support y'all. Or if y'all win the union, we're not going to be able to expand the store. We were going to expand the store and set up another store. You could have been one of our new managers. But, well, what can I tell you? We can't accommodate it. If we start the union here, well, you know what? You know, we just simply can't afford all that the union costs with them coming in and them big fat cigar-smoking fat cats gobbling up all our profit. On and on and on. A relentless barrage of anti-union activity, anti-union argument, anti-union propaganda. This is what's been hitting the workers ever since the company saw they had an election coming. And apparently, their anti-union offensive worked. Brothers and sisters, it's a disgrace on a certain level. But let this be a lesson, because the next time you don't just say that you're for a union. let me give you a little secret here. When you say that you are for a National Labor Relations Board election, and then you go on strike, according to the law, it's illegal for the employers to hire people and replace you with them. Yes, they can hire people. That's true. But they're not supposed to replace. You're still supposed to be able to walk back to your job when the strike is over. But here's the real point. If you ain't ready to fight for a union, you don't deserve one. Ain't nobody gonna drop a union in your damn lap. You got to fight for it. You got to struggle for it. And that means you have to be willing to withdraw your labor, to throw down the gauntlet and defeat the company. Now, is it true in this period that there are literally thousands of people that are prepared to scab on you? Yes, that's true. But once a real strike was in motion, it's no telling what would have been like, what it would have been like in Berkeley. People running around out there, and you know how we do in Berkeley. People get crazy as hell when there's some real struggle going on. So without, you know, trying to slip in with the little election did not work. 119 against the union, 70 for the union. Let's think this over, this strategy that the trade union bureaucracy has given us, that we do it peaceful, legal. We don't need to strike to build unions. This is why it's under this stewardship of this leadership of the American working class that the unions have gone from 33% down to 11%. When do we reverse the trend? When do we reject the losing strategies of this trade union bureaucracy? Well, we're going to have to do some hard, long thinking. Because I tell you what, I even entertained delusions that they were going to win. Especially after everybody signed the card. That means that the company's intimidation tactics worked. We have to face that and understand that individuals are weak and can, in fact, quote, change their mind. That is, be intimidated and frightened by the company into voting against their own self-interest. Let us continue. Well, I don't know how to say this, especially with all that old Patriot Act stuff going on, but it looked like old Wolfowitz almost bit a bullet there. And you know he boo-booed on himself when it happened, because when they shot the rockets in the building, Wolfowitz was not hit directly with one of the rockets. He was on the 12th floor. The rockets went on the 13th to 15th floor. They missed him. But he had to be helped out the building. There's only one explanation here. That rocket hit, he dropped a little load in his pants, probably wee-weed on himself, and they had to help him out the building because he was shaking it. Little old teeth chattering and everything. Yeah. See, it's punks like Wolfowitz, you understand, that could point around and tell people to kill other folks. But when that shit happened to him, he couldn't hold, lost his composure. Had to help him out the damn building.
Well, you could tell at the little press conference that he gave afterwards, that he was all shook up. All shook up. One little RPG. And he was all shook up.
Yeah, well,
after all that big bad talk.
Yeah.
I expected him to strap on an M1 and go looking for the guys the way they've been wolfing it up and stuff. Instead, he was hiding in the bunker and stuff.
Yeah, well, you don't have to worry about Mr. Wolfowitz strapping on anything but some stockings. Because, actually, homeboy is all talk. And he ain't got, it takes heart to actually get out there and do the fighting. He ain't with it. Definitely ain't with it. The Iraqi resistance has grown bolder. The rocket strike on Baghdad's Al Rashid Hotel underlined the increasing daring nature of the attacks Iraqis blame on Washington's failure to transfer power. Even U.S. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, who emerged uninjured from the hotel after the attack, admitted the coalition could not guarantee full protection for targets such as the Al Rashid Hotel. And by the way, y'all should know this is where they have the leadership. The American leadership is in that hotel. So the Iraqis was pretty much on the mark hitting that hotel. I ain't gonna say that. I'm a journalist.
Well, actually, this is more like it. Instead of running around killing Iraqis who were Christians, like some of those knuckleheads were doing, as if Iraqis who were Christians weren't catching the same bombs as their neighbors who were Muslims.
Yeah, but that's one of the problems. Following up with a regime like Saddam ran, Saddam wasn't no joke. If he thought you was opposition, he's going to do you in. So you didn't have the exercise in building an opposition movement that could educate the people. They ran everybody out, you know. So that religious shit is the only thing that's really around, is what I'm...
Well, yeah. I mean, right now, many people look at some of this invisible man stuff through the Islamic framework as the vehicle, without looking at many of these guys... who are now in resistance to U.S. domination were co-conspirators, and some are, in destabilizing other regions throughout the hemisphere. So it's not like they're truly liberator fighters. They're just upset that Sam is on their doormat and that they have a conflict with Sam. But many of them had gotten their training from Sam in the past. So their version of liberation struggle is often quite warped.
Yeah, it is. But they got a new group out now in Iraq called the Liberation Front. And reportedly, there are 3,000 Iraqi officers that are part of this movement. So these cats know what they're doing. And they did receive training in the United States.
Oh, we're not saying that some of these guys can't shoot and don't know how to handle weapons.
Oh, yeah.
That's not what I'm talking about at all.
Oh, you're talking about their mindset.
Yeah. You know, and what is their version of organizing a struggle for the emancipation of people? It is the difference between shooting out an enemy in the name of getting rid of them, and then setting up your version well, in other words, look, many of those guys in the Taliban played a very courageous role in their battles against the Soviets. You know, they had heart and everything like that. But their version of a society, right, was warped. So the fact that they had heart, knew how to handle guns and stuff like that, is different than what their version of a just and humane society is.
Yeah. Very different. Mr. Wolfowitz, you know, he had to run his mouth and say that the U.S. would be unrelenting in its pursuit of the, quote, criminals who are trying to destabilize the country. Well, I guess he's going to have to shoot himself then, because that's exactly who he is, Boy George, Rumsfeld, and the rest of the crew. Yesterday, that strike that took place, rather, was undoubtedly the boldest at the heart of the U.S. Operations Center in Baghdad, following a first attack on September the 27th by three rockets that left only minor damage to the al-Rashid. Most anti-coalition attacks target U.S. troops in the so-called Sunni Triangle, Saddam Hussein's native region and stronghold. But on Saturday, a British coalition soldier was wounded in the southern city of Basra. On Saturday, 12 American troops were injured in attacks along the country that saw a Black Hawk helicopter crash and come under fire near Tikrit, where Wolfowitz was visiting troops. Maybe they were trying to get his ass. Guerrillas fired small arms and rocket-propelled grenades at the helicopter after it came down, wounding one soldier and causing the craft to explode in flames and spew a column of thick smoke. A preliminary report by U.S. soldiers, however, said that the helicopter was downed by gunfire, possibly by an RPG. Witnesses said they heard a loud explosion as two helicopters flew low overhead. Suddenly, one of the aircraft began swaying from side to side and came down about a mile away. In a separate incident near the flashpoint city of Fallujah, three civilians were killed and two wounded when their convoy came under fire. A U.S. engineer and an Iraqi sector security guard said U.S. troops shot at their vehicles. But the U.S. military denied that. Obviously, this is, you know, they panicking. Anything they see move, the troops are scared to death. They don't know what the enemy looked like, who the enemy, what they trying, what their mission, what they supposed to be. They just, if it moves, shoot it. This was an American they were shooting at.
And oftentimes, they've gotten away with this type of mad dog reaction. There's no thought whether they're... some of these guys aren't even scared. They're just mad dog trigger happy. And anything other than who's right there beside them, it's just going to get blown away.
Yeah.
And we've seen that happen deeply when we went over the issue of Somalia and how a lot of those things transpired. A lot of those guys knew that they were using ammunition, you know, 50 calibers and all of that, that was so powerful that they would just go on and on through buildings. It was hitting any and everyone well beyond their particular perceived target. They didn't care. They were just mowing down anything in sight.
Yeah. Yes, that is indeed part of the mindset. While the violence continued, about 25,000 protesters rallied in U.S. cities against the occupation of Iraq, demanding that troops be brought home and labeling President George W. Bush a liar. However, not all the news from Iraq was, was necessarily stuff about the United States getting wore out. They done begged up on these nations. They supposed to be getting $33 billion. We'll see. We'll see when it comes down to payday. Despite 6 months of aggressive raids to round up Saddam's loyalists and Wolfowitz's defiant pledge repeated yesterday to take the fight to the enemy, the daily rate of attacks has jumped from 13 to 15 to 20, that was a few months ago, to 20 to 25 attacks per day. The number of U.S. soldiers killed in combat since major hostilities were declared over on May 1st has reached 108 before the rockets hit the Baghdad Hotel, and now it has exceeded the number of people of U.S. troops killed after May 1st is more than died during when they was actually call themselves in the so-called war. Now, understand this, folks. They're not talking about people that committed suicide. They're not talking about people that are dying from radiation poisoning. They're not talking about people that just die. You know, maybe a few might die a natural death, although not many. But there's a lot of other people dying over there that don't get reported. Because they're only talking about, and I'm sure they're not even talking about all of the raids where people get killed. So this is a political issue, and the Pentagon plays their cards very close to their chest. Assaults have also targeted U.S.-installed interim Iraqi government council members. Why don't we just call them Uncle Toms for short? These so-called religious leaders, government members, and United Nations, and, of course, they've been popping a lot of holes in them pipelines. General Ricardo Sanchez, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, recently admitted the attackers, quote, are demonstrating local coordination and synchronization, unquote. These are destructive terrorist actions, says Antifa Kanbar, spokesman for leading council member Ahmad Taliba, head of the Iraqi National Congress and a longtime Pentagon favorite. The attacks are escalating. They are becoming bolder. The solution is to hand over security matters and sovereignty to Iraqi hands, he says. Yeah, well, which Iraqi hands, my friend? That's the real question. And how would it be settled? Key council member Anand Pachachi said on Saturday that Al-Qaeda had moved its field of operations into Iraq because of the large U.S. military presence there. I want to tell you something. This ain't no Al-Qaeda operation. Believe me, the Iraqi people are generating a serious resistance. Amid coalition plans to start moving troops out of Baghdad by April, council members have blasted U.S. troops for using excessive force against civilians, and at last month's UN General Assembly, they call for a power transfer. And now I just want to go slightly, this is since we're talking about it. If you recall, George Bush had to administer discipline, he felt, to the Malaysian prime minister, who he said had made an anti-Semitic remark. Well, it doesn't look like the prime minister is accepting the criticism. Barrow, over a recent speech by Malaysia's prime minister in which he alleged that the world is controlled by Jews, has escalated. Dr. Mahathir Mohamad dismisses claims U.S. leader rebuked him over Jew remark. That was Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad's latest repost in the continuing exchange over whether he was ticked off by the American leader over his remarks that Jews rule the world. Quote, "It's the biggest lie. If he had rebuked me, I'm quite sure I would have rebuked him also," the combative Malaysian leader told reporters here after arriving home from Papua New Guinea. "I think he wants to support his officer," he added, alluding to White House spokesman Scott McClellan. So here we got now everybody, even the little prime minister, the little backwater country, standing up to old boy George and say, "Fuck you, Mike." They ain't with it. They ain't with it. I don't understand. Usually, if boy George say, "Woo, woo, woo, woo," then they get on their knees. "Yes, master, woo, 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 woo." Something going on, y'all.
It's the Fidel syndrome. Fidel was the originator of all that stuff. Yeah. Stomping around in his combat boots all over the planet in defiance of Sam. Mm.
Well, you remember, here on Slave Revolt, we very dutifully brought up the issue of Cynthia McClintock. Remember? She spoke in the Bay Area last week, and this has come up again. And listen how, as I predicted that there were going to be problems between Jewish Americans and Black Americans, so now let's look at the Black-Jew rift is widening after the Southern primaries. Participants in this month's Congressional Black Caucus Conference say the defeat of two Black House members, House of Representatives, in bitter primaries not only suggests a widening rift with Jewish Democrats, but trouble within the Democratic Party itself. This at the moment when the Democratic Party thinks that they're going to show boy George the dough in 2004. Well, we'll see. "People are talking retaliation," said Ron Waters, the director of the African American Leadership Institute at the University of Maryland. Last week's Congressional Black Caucus events in Washington. Quote, "They are saying that presidential hopeful Senator Joe Lieberman is dead in the water," and so on and so forth. The anger is emanating from reports that several outside Jewish special interest groups took a particular interest in defeating Representative Cynthia McKinney, Democrat from Georgia, and Earl Hilliard, Democrat from Alabama, by fueling the campaigns of their respective Democratic primary opponents with thousands of dollars and an interest in seeing the incumbents defeated for their long-standing support of the Palestinians. Now look, I'm going to tell you something, folks. It wasn't only money, because I believe in McKinney's case, at least, it was an open primary. This is one of their latest little tricks. So what happened was the Republicans sent their people a vote against McKinney in the primary. Now, what it should be is if a party, Democratic Party, has a primary, you have to be a registered Democrat to vote in that primary. Peace and Freedom Party has a primary, you should be a Peace and Freedom Party member to vote in that primary. Only. Well, that's not the way it goes with this open primary stuff. And this shows you why it's bad. Because then it can be manipulated in many ways. So you don't even get the voice of the party. See, this is about American politics. They have depoliticized it to the point where they just do any old crap and get away with it for now. Well, both incumbents lost in stunning defeats. McKinney blamed the Jewish lobby and the Democratic Party for her October 20th primary loss by 16 percentage points to Judge Denise Mayette, who is also black. The five-termer had sparked the ear of the Jewish community with her outreach to Arabs, particularly after September 11th attacks, and her support of Palestinians in light of terrorist bombings in Israel. She received ample financial support in her campaign from Arab groups. Hilliard, too, is a fervent supporter of Palestinians and lost in June 56-44% to his opponent, Arthur Davis, who is also black and was supported heavily by Jewish special interest dollars. Let's understand something here. Black. Yeah, they's black, all right, but they knew what they were doing. This is almost a COINTELPRO-like operation, brothers and sisters, because it also included the media barrage, lies about these people. A character assassination, saying that she was crazy.
And the Democratic Party.
Oh, yeah.
The Democratic Party played a role in letting them bite the dust. They didn't come in any way to their defense. In many ways, the Democratic Party participated in the onslaught.
Yes.
So if black people who rightfully should be going and pointing their aim at the special interest lobby, Jewish lobby groups that were involved, they should also be pointing their pistol sights at the Democratic Party.
Absolutely.
Because they played a role in muting and defeating Cynthia McKinley. And also, they played a role in allowing the 2000 presidential election in Florida to take place, where blacks and others were scrubbed off the voter roll by the computer software. And the Democratic Party willingly did not put up a fight.
Right.
Because they were not willing to discredit the state and show how barbaric the state was. They were willing to allow all of the civil rights wars that black people had fought for, like the right to vote, to go up in flame, to be mocked and ridiculed, rather than to expose how vile this system really is.
Yes, thank you, Tracy, and that's right. But there is a difference in the cowardice of the Democratic Party, particularly Gore, in conceding the election in that way and not fighting, when actually there was already a fight underway, by the way. They called it off. They pulled Jesse Jackson back. But this is like, is what they did to McKinney and them.
But she even mentions that the two prongs that were aided in her defeat were the Jewish lobby and the Democratic Party.
Yes, she does.
She says that herself.
Did you see her?
No, not this recent one.
Well, yes. No, absolutely correct. No question. Walters said their defeats were payback from the wealthy Jewish lobby. Quote, when you unseat two black candidates, it's not a freak thing, it's a strategy. It took black candidates by surprise and it made them very angry, he said. While the leadership of the party didn't do anything, that's the big memory. That's the big mystery, he thinks. But it was no mystery at all. Political observers say McKinley was the only one to blame for her own defeat. She alienated the Democratic Jewish community after September 11 when she slammed former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani for returning a $10 million check to a Saudi prince who had linked the attacks to America's Mideast policy. McKinney wrote the prince a letter criticizing Giuliani and asking for the money back to give to poor black communities. That's right. You see, now they didn't. Now that, to me, that ain't nothing. Others say McKinley didn't just. They think that was really honorable for Giuliani to say, "No, I don't want your dirty oil money."
It's all posturing.
Yeah, all
they're
posturing.
All in bed with those Prestige Saudi princes and stuff.
Oh, come on, you, obviously, man. You know, others say McKinley didn't speak to black voters in her district anymore. While Republican voters who could vote in the primary crossed lines en masse to help defeat her, you see? But that's messed up. Quote, there is a wide variety of reasons as to why the defeat might have happened, said John Norton, spokesman for the Democratic National Committee. Norton said the party does not get involved in primaries, but in this case, We would never pin it that that is the defeat on a group of outsiders who are wed to a particular issue. Well, that's silly, because that's exactly what happened. So you're trying, the Democratic Party is trying to cover their tracks by denying reality. Despite the following the building case against McKinney, political analysts agree that Jews, though traditionally loyal to the Democratic Party, have been moving further to the right since President Bush took office. The president's support of Israel, combined with his compassionate conservatism, has done a lot to soften their attitudes against Republicans in the last year. Quote, Jews are clearly moving in a conservative direction, particularly at city and state levels, said Murray Friedman, head of the Center for Jewish History at Temple University and author of What Went Wrong, The Creation and Collapse of the Black-Jewish Alliance. Jewish-black relations have been waxing and waning since the 1960s, he said, and tensions uncovered in the Hilliard and McKinney races are just a continuation of that. Actually, I would argue, no, this is a qualitative leap into the abyss. This is far worse. This is the worst thing I've ever seen. You know, and I've been paying attention to this kind of stuff my whole life. This is pretty bad.
Well, you know, as I stated before, you know, black people, we got to be careful as far as having a short-term memory of how often people are targeted within our group. For when I say group, I'm talking about, you know, just black people in general. I'm not talking about whether they're Democrats or independents or whatever, but how black people often find themselves in the crosshair of these things. In the Washington papers a few years ago, you had a number of Republicans and other people who were bragging on how they aided in the defeat of a black candidate by basically paying payola to various ministers throughout.
Yep.
And how this was a strategic effort. Then it came out where a number of black people who had won office at least one time found themselves in the grip of FBI investigations. It was extremely systematic right before their next candidacy came up. They find themselves in the grips of these FBI investigations, which would throw off their electoral run, and they would be defeated because their name is all of a sudden getting implicated with all of this
negative
kind of crime, corruption,
right,
and stuff like that. And as the book, as the brother who wrote the book, Eyes of My Soul, he was a former FBI agent. He outlined how this was
a
systematic attack, intentional, designed, and stuff. So black people have often found themselves in the most vile and vicious forms of attack. And he goes over several mayors who were attacked. Sometimes the various folks just lose their mind and just imagine stuff. Like the one mayor where Joe Lewis was from, I think it's St. Louis.
Yes.
They had a statue in his commemoration. It wasn't a full body statue. It was just a statue of a fist that the artist actually had made. So these little, you know, nuts just think that this is some kind of symbolic black power salute.
Yeah.
So they start going after the mayor to systematically, knock him out. So this is the precarious situation that black people have often found themselves in this society. If we're not bobbing our heads and bucking and shucking to who's ever tuned, because most people in this society think we should be shoe-shining for them. And if we ain't got our heads down shoe-shining for them at their beckoning call, we'll often find ourselves in the crosshairs.
Yes, sir. Now, Friedman said, past anti-Semitic rhetoric against Jews by visible members of the black community, like, they say, Reverend Al Sharpton and Reverend Jesse Jackson. Well, actually, their little shit is nothing compared to Farrakhan. So you noticed, even this little, you know. And the fact that there was no clear support for Israel by black members in recent resolutions in Congress have exacerbated this growing rift between the two traditional allies. Quote, it's not helpful to have this rift out in the open, This spells trouble for the Democratic Party, says Rich Galen, who is Jewish and a Republican strategist. He says if black voters follow through with plans to retaliate against the party for not doing more to save McKinney and Hilliard's seats, it could be disastrous. Yeah, could be.
For who?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, he said at the same time, he said Democratic Jews may be wondering where the party was when the black lawmakers were making statements against Israel. They always got to try to make it even-handed, you know.
But as if being critical of Israel is automatically a negative.
Well,
you're automatically off-cuff.
Anti-Semitic.
Right. A kook, you know. So when he talks about it being disastrous, this is the same type of rhetoric that when blacks started to form their own patrols, bat patrols and other things, because they lost confidence in the police during the Wayne Williams episode in the 80s.
In Atlanta.
Many people said that this was disastrous. And the reason why is because they saw that black people were losing their illusion about being protected by the police. That's
exactly
what was disastrous, that a consciousness was developing and black people were turning to themselves to organize for their own self-independence and liberation. That's what they call disastrous. Anytime you go outside of the box, that is disastrous to those who want to keep us in the box and
that's
on
right.
the plantation.
Right on. All ends up spelling trouble for the Democrats, huh? Walter said the party had gone on double duty to quell the anger among blacks who are by a vast majority Democrat. He doesn't buy that McKinney has lost support among the black voters in the district, but blames Republicans and Jewish outsiders and a lot of support from the party, and a lack of support from the party. I just don't know why the Democratic leadership didn't step up and wrestle this to the ground, he complains. Now, you're talking about illusions. Here the ship is sinking and whole Sambo's thing. What's the matter, boss? What's wrong with the boat? A handful of congressional black caucus members have approached the leadership not to blame them for their members' losses, but to request meetings, even a retreat, to help ease the
issue
growing
shining
tension
too
between the Jewish and the black factions within the party. Staff members said Tuesday.
See, the black caucus. This is what's so sad about these little Sambos. I mean, it exposes that they're not serious, which is good. But if they were serious, they would be doing national tours in the black community to explain the ins and outs in politics and the issues that are addressing black people and other people and how to forge some links. You know, but see, since they don't have a real program that's for a real emancipation from this madness, they can't get into engaged in this type of stuff because they're as afraid as any of these little knuckleheads out there of stirring the consciousness of the masses of black folks. Because once the tornado gets twirling, there's no telling when and where it's going to stop.
Yeah, exactly right. It is rather sickening and disheartening that this late date Negroes are still so slavish. Some Negroes. Fred Turner, a spokesman for Representative Alcee Hastings, Democrat of Florida, said his boss, quote, has been talking to his colleagues, both black and Jewish, to make things better. We have to remind people that there is still quite a bit of shared history between the two groups. Eric Smith, the spokesman for the House Majority Leader, Dick Gephardt, who met recently with CBC members on the matter, said there was definite agreement to clear up the tensions that exist. That's not the problem, but the tensions. He acknowledges that it would be good to continue the discussion. Hell no, ain't nothing to talk about. That's it.
Plus, this is when they get a bunch of ministers and they start hooping and hollering about traditions of solidarity and a couple of people who walk with King and all of that. It is. This is like when some little raggedy, low-life dog, savage cop shoots some little kid in the back. And then there's some meetings at a church or whatever, and you have all these angry black people clamoring on what to do next. And then up pops old Preacher Man, and he starts talking about how the police aren't the only ones that sin. We got our own problems in our community. We be shooting ourselves, and we can't look at the police as enemies.
Yeah.
You know, we got to clean house first. And, you know, after all now, what the Lord said, you know, and on and on and on. See, this is a Mantan performance. They're not trying to resolve the issue as far as what are the crucial class and historical issues that blacks face, and where should we go from here. They just want us to get right back in that same molasses, and then eventually you just drown in the molasses.
Thank you very much, Tracy, and that's going to be all for the Make It a Play News Service. Please stay with us.
Almost unprecedented to bring this many senior decision makers in the executive branch and their contractors together to discuss nuclear policy. On the sort of terms of reference for this meeting are topics like how to frame the discussion in Congress, what kind of authority do we need to begin small production runs of special weapons. Is the production complex agile enough to make these special weapons at short notice? What kind of nuclear testing do we need? And, of course, what are the weapons we want that will be, as they put it, most likely to be used? It is really a breathtaking agenda. And yesterday I learned that those congressional staff members, committee staff members who want to just come and observe are being barred from the meeting. So we have a meeting which is pretty much stacked with contractors, and it would be inaccurate not to say just ideologues, and congressional oversight is being stiffed at the door. There are quite a few different candidates for production that will be discussed. We know this because the subject has come up in the 1990s. These plans aren't exactly new, but they have legs in the Bush administration they didn't have before. So there are going to be high-yield weapons discussed. There are going to be earth-penetrating weapons, so-called agent defeat weapons, which are optimized to attempt the crazy mission of trying to incinerate biological weapons or chemical weapons. There are going to be enhanced radiation weapons. Maybe you remember that, neutron bombs. There may even be some microwave weapon ideas brought to the table. We don't know all the kinds of weapons, but we know that they will run the gamut. Keith Payne wrote an article in 1980. I think the title was Why Not Victory? There he suggested that the United States might be able to absorb losses of 20 million dead in a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. Which, as you may remember, is not too different than what Buck Turgidson said in Dr. Strangelove. He has been very active in think tank circles that are close to the Bush administration, the NIP, the National Institute for Public Policy. I think he is or was the president. I haven't kept up whether he is in government in Mr. Rumsfeld's shop at this moment or he's gone back to NIP. In any case, our best information was he was going to be there. Now, whether that's true or not, it's actually not too important because his co-authors of that 1980 article are in the Bush administration as well. People that were on the margins at one time are now very central in policymaking. Human kind of fell into our hands. We can't take a lot of credit for it wasn't one of these documents that you struggle for a year to get. It just kind of fell out of the sky. We would like to know who exactly is going to be there. We'd like to know what exactly is the agenda. We'd like to know what are the so-called pre-reads, the material circulated to the committee members, and what will be the outcome of this meeting, and how will it be applied in the decision-making process. All of this is hard to pry out, and I'm afraid that one of the things that makes it more difficult is that the Democratic opposition to these nuclear weapons policies is not firm enough. Most of the Democrats are a little passive about this, perhaps because they don't understand how dynamic this process is and how many of the cards in the deck already are in the hands of those who would proceed with nuclear testing, with development of these new weapons.
Everything I knew was wrong. Energy that's going to flow out from that light off.
All right, up next, we're about to take a trip beyond the shadow. You know, often people try to say, or like to believe, or try to get certain portions of the population to take politics out of sports. But in reality, in a capitalist system where part of the goal of the system is to market the sport and the players as products to entice people to be mesmerized and hypnotized by the athletes and the spectacle of the sport, and also for diversionary aspects, you often cannot avoid politics in sports. Now, recently, Warren Sapp, he plays football for the defending champions, Tampa Bay Buccaneers football team. He was asked by Michael Irvin, who's a former football player, used to play for the Dallas Cowboys as a receiver. He's asked Warren to justify his comments about being a slave. So let's see what Warren meant by that. And let's take it beyond the shadows. Check it out.
This is a quote. Make no mistake about it. Slave masters say you can't do it. Don't do it. They'll make an example of you. First, I want you to explain those comments, but start with, who are the slave masters?
Okay. The whole thing is, there has to be somebody that's in charge.
Okay.
That's what I'm talking about.
Who's in charge?
The league officer's in charge.
You gotta go to the head man. You gotta go to the head man. The man comes out and says, I'm lucky I'm not suspended. What have I done to get suspended?
The man, Tagliabue.
Yeah, this is his quote. I'm lucky I'm not suspended. What have I done to be suspended?
They say you bump a rep one time, that's 15,000. You bump him twice, that's 25,000.
I guess you just bypass all your rules and you just go straight to suspension when it's out.
And they say they're sick of my antics. What have I done?
Well, they fining you an awful lot.
This isn't just one event that comes up and says, here. This is a 9-year career of a bunch of injustices about this league. That's why I made the statement I made. It wasn't about packing all of us in 250 different, you know, ethnic backgrounds and whatever. We sworn to hate each other and pack us all in the ship and go 1,600 miles across the ocean. That's not what I'm talking about here. That's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about a game that's supposed to be fun, entertaining, and exciting.
Now, basically what happened was Warren often skips through the opposing team's warm-ups, you know, before the game starts. So they stopped him from doing that, and then he started to skip through the sideline before the game starts. And he bumped into a ref, and it was clear it was an accident. The ref didn't take it like it was on purpose or anything. But just for bumping into the ref, apparently, accident or not sometimes, because no one's accused him, he gets the fine. But, you know, if you bump into a ref, as Sapp was saying, a third time, that's when the suspension usually happens. And they're talking about bumping into a ref in the heat of the matter, in the heat of the game, you know, where you're mad about a call and you bump up against them, you're not supposed to touch the ref, et cetera, et cetera. So they just take liberty to, you know, basically just get the role of the athlete. It's, you know, football, basketball especially, is that you're just supposed to get out there, shut up and play, perform, monkey. That's it. So if you go outside of those boundaries, you often find yourself in the crosshairs, because the whole concept of being a role model and all of that is that you're supposed to play the role that the corporations feel will make you appealable to whatever market that they're trying to aim their product at, you know, shoes, soft drinks, whatever. Now, these are the same people quite often that hold the most menacing images on the planet. That's often has been created by some of these same corporate overlords and myth makers in the first place. So they often find themselves trying to neuter any images that may offend a particular market. Now, if it's basketball and shoes per se, then you can kind of have, you know, kind of the hip-hop flair and this and that, because those basketball shoes are primarily being bought by urban and rural kids who, you know, won't hold a negative type of position towards an athlete who, you know, has braids or whatever. But when you're selling some of these other drinks, that's often when, you know, or some of these other products, they want to try to neuter you as much as possible. And this is in part what Warren is trying to get at. Now, some of this other aspect about talking about all these slaves who were different ethnic groups who were sworn enemies, that's just him babbling. Because for the most part, you know, a lot of these were the same regions that black people were bought from. And some of the main divisions were the divisions that were bought by crusading forces of Christian and Islamic forces that had divided black people up on those particular lines and had played a devastating role in the history of the slave trade. So it's a three-pronged thing. Kingships, which have played a role in slavery, which all societies have had. The term Slav, you know, Slavics, you know, who are whites, they were being enslaved so much that the term Slav for Slavics and slave became synonymous. So, you know, and so you've had kingships that played a prong in the role of slavery, then the Islamic slave trade, and then the transatlantic slave trade, Christian base. Those have been the devastating impacts on black people. Next, Sapp talks about who's able to market who in this society. So let's see what he means by that, and we'll take it from there. Check this.
Can't take your helmet off. That would help my marketability, wouldn't it? That's how basketball players get it. They walk around with little shorts on and tank top. You can see their faces. Can't see our faces, but we play the most popular game in the world, and nobody knows who we are.
You said they won't allow you to take off your helmet. You know, that was when we were playing. Emmitt Smith used to do it.
Emmitt and I talked about that in the locker room. Like, Mike, they don't know who we are. Man, we got to start taking the helmet off when we score a touchdown,
exactly.
Man.
Exactly. Get your face out there.
Why did the NFL stop you from doing that? Why did they stop? Well, they stopped us first, but why did they stop players from doing that?
I think it's more than anything of you can't promote you. You can't promote you. As an individual, as a great player in this league, it's unforeseeable for you to try to raise your own status in life or your image or something. Because that's the only way I can see it. That's the only way I can see. If the game is supposed to be about the players in it, then allow us to make ourselves household names, household faces. And that's not what it's about. It's about that shield. If you ain't promoting that shield,
the NFL shield,
you are wrong. You are dead wrong.
And that's where the slave master come in.
Because a slave wasn't allowed to do it. You weren't representative of 1/4 of a man. Right?
Mm-hmm.
1/4 of a man. Pretty much what they want. 1/4 of a man, then all y'all come together, you equal a team. But you equal an NFL team. No individual personalities allowed.
Well, actually, it was 3/5 of a person. But besides that, what basically happens is that players who want to make money off of their image have often found themselves in the crosshairs. Years ago, when Michael Jordan went and played in the Olympics in Barcelona, he saw that his there were a lot of shirts being sold in his image, and it was done by, you know, people from America. It wasn't being done by people over there. And Michael Jordan has a patent on his image, so he called them on it, and then they started screaming, "You're unpatriotic," and all of that type of stuff. Now, what's interesting is that, you know, historically, if blacks had gone bankrupt, you know, like fighters like Joe Louis and all of that, they start to chastise the black athletes for not and or entertainers for not being more responsible. Then, when they play the quote-unquote responsible role, in other words, they market themselves in a similar pattern that the traditional businessman does, only it's really based off of their own particular labor, then all of a sudden, hell and brimstone befalls them. And that's basically because, in essence, athletes' role through the eyes of many people in this sector is basically to be a product that is to be controlled by and profited off of the right businessmen. And that means everyone but, for the most part, the athletes themselves. So that's where a lot of that really comes in. And so next, Sapp is asked by a former Dallas Cowboy receiver about how some people say that, hey, you make millions of dollars. What are you complaining about? You shouldn't be complaining at all. So let's see what they have to say about that. Check this.
People at home that says and see that you make millions and millions of dollars, maybe they get offended by you making a comparison between playing a game, making millions of dollars, and slaves. Given the opportunity, would you take back that comment?
The only comment I've ever made in this league that I'll take back is calling Mark Gastineau a convicted felon and he shouldn't have his NFL sack record. But that's something that was personal for him. And I've apologized too many times. I'm sorry again, Mark. I mean, it's just one of those deals. But what I see and what I experience, I'm here. I've been here for 9 years.
But now, do you think when you start talking about slave masters,
since you make money, you're supposed to shut up? Is that what I'm being told? As a black man in America, since you're making money, you need to shut up. If it ain't right, it ain't right. That's it. That's the only thing with me. If it ain't right, it ain't right.
ESPN contacted the NFL office on Saturday night. The league says they are not concerned about Warren's remarks about the league office. As long as they believe he does not abuse the referees in any way, they say everything will be just fine.
All right, so once again, you have a situation where you have one. People, for the most part, now that black athletes play such a predominant role, you know, NBA is like 80% black. The NFL is overwhelmingly black athletes. So you have people who want to market them, and they don't want to market black people speaking from their own perspective and their own consciousness, especially if it's developed. They don't want any Ali's. And what they'll do is they'll frame it that you mess up your marketability by being consciousness or speaking out on subject matters like that. Now, it's okay to market, let's say, Nike Corporation, even though Nike Corporation's in the forefront of helping exploit people throughout the world. So it's not about any real moral sense or anything. Because in essence, it's all about acquiescing to the structure of the society that basically just makes you someone who entertains with a mute on. Now, the other aspect of you do have people who, you know, we have such a low level of consciousness in this society that any person speaking out about how there's various ways of being quote-unquote enslaved in this society brings out the ire, because the value system is so warped that if you make a certain amount of money, then everything else is supposed to be okay. And you shouldn't have any complaints, especially if you're a black person. So, you know, these are the things that Sapp has found himself, surrounded in. But in the whole aspect of this race politics and sports, and how many people call for us to leave race politics and sports alone. In the middle of this, here we have Rush Limbaugh, who recently stated his views about a black quarterback, Donovan McNabb. So let's see if let's leave race and politics out of sports is something that other people adhere to. Check this out.
Donovan McNabb is regressing. He's going backwards. I'm sorry to say this, I don't think he's been that good from the get-go. I think what we've had here is a little social concern in the NFL. I think the media has been very desirous that a black quarterback do well.
Okay, now, if he doesn't think McNabb is that good or was ever that good, McNabb's a current quarterback in Philadelphia, that's fine. But as you heard, here Limbaugh tries to say that it was the media that tried and wanted to prop him up out of some kind of social concern. So, in other words, he's saying that the media gives McNabb, because he's a black quarterback, preferential treatment. Now, McNabb is not having that good of a year this year, but there's a number of quarterbacks who are having a terrible year because quarterbacks, one, is a very precarious and vulnerable position. The Oakland quarterback, Gannon, Rich Gannon, terrible this year. You know, actually he's being replaced, even though, you know, he's injured, they want him replaced. Jeff Garcia is having a terrible year for the San Francisco 49ers. A lot of quarterbacks have up and down years because you get injured, so on and so forth. But see, that's not what Limbaugh is saying. It's Limbaugh who's playing the race card. It was Limbaugh who was trying to say that McNabb is given preferential treatment. Now, McNabb has been voted as a Pro Bowler 3 times. This hasn't been by the media. It wasn't by the coaches. It was by his own peers. Players vote who goes into the Pro Bowl. So 3 times McNabb has been voted in as an all-star into the Pro Bowl. So his own peers see him as one of the elite players in the league in his position. So once again, you have Limbaugh, who is just some little right-wing rat trap commentator getting hired for ESPN to commentate on professional sports. And what does he quite naturally do? He brings in some kind of warped racial equation into this thing. So as much as people like to condemn black people or athletes for bringing race into sports or politics or whatever, we're constantly thrust in there because we're constantly getting bombarded with it and have to defend ourselves every step of the way. So that's the real world. Now, recently you have a situation where there's a conflict between Vic, who's the quarterback for Atlanta, and his coach. Vic got hurt. He broke his leg in the preseason, and he says he won't be ready for December 7th. He was hoping, he said that he would be back sooner, but he doesn't think he'd make it back before December 7th. The Atlanta Falcons are doing terrible without him. And now his coach is saying, you should be back, come back earlier. And he's been saying this in the press and stuff. Now, Vic obviously knows how he feels. He doesn't want to get hurt again. He doesn't want to come back already injured and make it worse. But see, this coach, the coach's job is resting on Vic, this black quarterback. And it's clear that this coach is more concerned with his own personal career than he is for the overall health of this quarterback. Now, I'm not saying he's doing it because he's black, because I don't believe that's the case. I think that the coach would be saying it regardless. But what I'm saying is, my point of bringing this up is that there's politics in all of these things that have to be looked at. And to think that is this some kind of, clear slate where if athletes don't have some consciousness about their own health and situation, who else is going to look at them? You know, who else is going to be concerned with? I mean, you have a situation where these football players, they have a shortened life expectancy because of the brutality of the sport. Many of them walk away from the game crippled. You better be conscious about your surroundings and situations, race consciously, social consciously, politically, and everything else for your own good. Now, but to show you how this stuff gets spun, on a KNBR 680 AM, former Warriors basketball player Rick Barry has a show, and he explains to a silly listener how what Rush babbled out wasn't race-related. Let's see what the hell he has to say, and we'll take it from there. Check this.
In a negative fashion towards him. I mean, it was an insult perhaps to McNabb because he was saying that he didn't think McNabb played all that well and got more recognition than he deserved. And it was a foolish comment on his part, but it wasn't something that was said in a very derogatory manner with regard to the color of McNabb's skin.
True.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your input on that one. Thanks so much, and you take care, Gene.
Thanks.
Let's go to Gary.
Rick Barry doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. Rush Limbaugh was clearly playing the race card when he tried to say that the media was being basically subservient to McNabb because they want to coddle and see black quarterbacks do well. In other words, they give black quarterbacks preferential treatment. Media doesn't care about that any more than the coaches do. They just see that there's a lot of quick and good mobile black quarterbacks, and a lot of them have good arms, so they just using them. That's all there's to that. I mean, some black athlete being coddled by the media, please. But for Rick Barry to try to do an end around and try to protect Rush shows how this whole stuff goes in circles. But now, here's Limbaugh. Let's see how Limbaugh spins it after he resigns from ESPN when there is some kind of turmoil over what he said. Check this out.
Limbaugh, to say the least. This morning he spoke before a group of radio broadcasters, and he did not suggest that his words were misinterpreted. He was calm, he was confident, he was unapologetic as he described why it is he resigned from ESPN last night.
To me, being honest is what's called for in a situation like anybody can, you know, phony it up and offer platitudes and cliches and so forth, and that's not me. And I figured if I'm going to do this, I better be who I am, and that's what they wanted, and they were vigorously defending it. But what happened was that some of my cast members began to be made to feel uncomfortable by the press and others who couldn't believe that they had not responded to what I said. So the path of least resistance became for me to resign.
Well, this is silly. You're a big, bad right-winger, Limbaugh. Why didn't you just resist it and stuff? Why didn't you just stay in there and hold your ground? Basically, this little fat punk couldn't defend his position, so he just, ran out. Everyone knew that McNabb is a respected player. So to try to spin it off on his cast members, who were muted and stuff, but that just shows how gumpified the whole situation is. And some of those cast members were some little Negroes sitting in there that let Limbaugh say that comment without saying comment back. But now the NFL started to say something to ESPN along with the Philadelphia owner, Jeffrey Lowry. So let's see what Lowry has to say about this whole Limbaugh statement, and then we'll examine it from there. Check this.
The problem, in my opinion, and I think many people's opinions, is that when you are in the business of hiring people like that or portraying athletes in a primarily African-American sport and want to completely disengage from reality in the seeking of ratings, it's a sad story.
So basically what you have here is that, look, the NFL and people like the owner get caught in a catch-22 because the NFL, as Sapp was pointing out, is constantly trying to mute them, but at the same token, and depoliticize them and not have them talk about anything. Then they try to get someone like Limbaugh gets on ESPN. He starts bringing up issues of race and this and that. And the last thing that they want to see is the masses of these little Negroes on the football plantation getting stirred up. So they say, hey, man, you messing up our stuff. You know, the majority of the players are black. You know, we got this strong following, and you're bringing this type of stuff up that's forcing these players to address what you say, and these are the various types of things that we want people to escape from. We don't want them to be politicized. We don't want to show them the politics of race, class, and labor, and every other aspect within this society. As we wrap this up real quick, here's Nab, Donovan McNabb. He's asked about Limbaugh's comments by a reporter on the issues of race and how in more than one way this thing has come full circle. Let's see what McNabb has to say to this reporter, and we'll take it from there. Check this.
Donovan, you said that nobody was there, and that concerns you a little bit, that nobody was there after Mr. Limbaugh made those comments. Are you suggesting that the other commentators on the set with Mr. Limbaugh could have stepped up and tackled the issue of race in the context in which he presented it?
Well, it definitely should have been tackled. You know, there were comments about my performance in the past couple of years, and why is it that, you know, that I'm looked upon this way because of the NFC Championship appearances and the success that I've had. But there was never any comments about being an African-American quarterback and why the league may be uplifting, you know, my stature because I'm a black quarterback and, you know, not because of my performance.
Michael Irvin was sitting right there. Would you have expected me to say something about the race issue?
Well, I'm not here to point out any of the guys. You know, there should have been a comment made, I mean, maybe from the camera guy. You know, somebody should have jumped out there and said something. You know, so I'm not pinpointing anyone. You know, I'm a Michael Irvin fan, Steve Young fan, Tom Jackson, you know, but somebody should have said something to the race issue.
Now, what's interesting about that is, you know, McNabb comments, and one of the reporters asked him how, you know, Michael Irvin didn't say anything. Irvin was on that panel with Limbaugh when Limbaugh had made the comments. Now, as you heard when I first started off this Beyond the Shadow segment, it was Irvin who was asking Sapp about his comments about being a slave. So, they have Irvin, and they don't have any problem running Irvin out there to question Sapp about using the image of himself being a slave in the NFL. So they don't have any problem with Irvin asking Sapp about that and challenging him on that. But when Irvin hears Limbaugh play the race card clearly, then Irvin knows, consciously or not, that it's not his place to even speak up. So it's okay for Limbaugh to bring up the issue that has racial connotations, but it's not okay for Sapp. So Irvin challenges Sapp, but he doesn't challenge Limbaugh, nor did the other black panel. This is also another aspect of how race is played in this society. Hold on a sec. Well, that's just going to about wrap it up for Slave tonight. As it's clear that as long as they are able to market us, market our labor, market our consciousness, market our soul, we'll be everything but free. and devoid from being or knowing what it truly means to be optimistic in this world today. Until the next time, slave revolt. Out.
The blackness, black, keep on. Blackness.